Sorry?
There is a KG together with me.
Okay, thank you.
Leslie, I gather you're going to start in Norwalk?
Yes, we are. Thank you very much. We're going to start today's meeting with a joint education session on our project on offsetting. It's going to be two segments, the first having to do with a presentation from some guests that we've invited to provide some additional information about derivative cash flows. Then we're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue our education session going through the memos that we were provided on unit of account. So with that, I'll hand over to Holly Barker, who's going to introduce this first section.
Thank you, Leslie. During May 17th, joint board meeting, boards discussed the feedback received on the exposure draft on offsetting financial assets and financial liabilities. Based on the feedback received, the boards requested further analysis of three issues before deciding on a way forward: unit of account, treatment of collateral variation margin, and simultaneous settlement criterion. For today's meeting, we will discuss the first two of these topics, unit of account and treatment of collateral, and we plan to discuss the simultaneous settlement criterion at a future board meeting. Representatives of the International Swap and Derivative Association and the London Clearinghouse will explain further the issues raised in comment letters on the treatment of collateral in the exposure draft. Once they have completed their presentation, we are scheduled for a 15-minute break, and then we'll resume the meeting with the ISB staff explaining the issues surrounding unit of account. At this time, I would like to ask the representatives from ISDA and LCH to please introduce themselves. Let's start here with the folks in Norwalk.
Great. Thanks, Holly. Good morning. I'm Dan Pelamanki. Work in the accounting policy area at Citigroup. And I'm representing ISDA as the chair of the North American Accounting Committee. And just to have everyone, I guess, first here in Norwalk briefly introduce themselves, and then we have some colleagues in London that will introduce themselves as well.
Lauren Smith, J.P. Morgan Chase, Executive Director in Accounting Policy.
Arthur Magnus, I'm a Managing Director, and I run global operations for the futures and options and OTC clearing core operations. I'm also co-chair of the ISDA Collateral Committee.
Alessandro Coco, Managing Director at J.P. Morgan. I run the derivatives and clearing legal group.
Sam Lin, Deputy Director of Accounting Policy at Goldman Sachs.
Greg Thompson, Global Head of Margin Lending, which is inclusive of derivatives clearing.
And is Tom, let you introduce folks there in London.
Okay, yes, my name is Tom Wise. I'm at HSBC. I'm also the chair of the European Accounting Committee of ISDA. On my right hand side.
No, that's all right, I can totally hear.
Very high tech, Cynthia. Shall we go?
Go ahead.
All right. Cynthia Mustafa, I'm the head of accounting policy for Deutsche Bank and a member of the ISDA accounting committee.
Dominique Armstrong, UBS, executive director, accounting policy.
And Marie Nordgren, technical director, Deutsche Bank accounting policy.
I also
have
LCH.
And I'm Martin Fairhurst, financial controller at LCH ClearNet in London.
And Rory Cunningham, director of public affairs, LCH ClearNet, London.
Okay, great. So this is Dan Pelamanki in Norwalk, and hopefully everybody has some slides that we prepared to go through and help guide the discussion this morning. We really appreciate the opportunity to spend time together today to talk through collateralized derivatives and the different types of settlement platforms that are out there. And you know, we certainly would welcome as much as many questions as folks have that you'd like to go through and explore on whatever level of detail, and we'll do our best to respond to those. And certainly, if you don't have the answers, we're happy to research that and get back to you with that information. But maybe just as a quick summary, a quick backdrop, based on information from the Bank of International Settlements, and surveys that have been conducted from an industry perspective, looking at the large dealers and derivatives today, roughly 80% of OTC derivative transactions are collateralized, and that's kind of based on the most recent survey. When you focus in on credit derivatives, for example, 93% of them are collateralized today in one fashion or another. And as you go through and look at different types of counterparties, you know, there's a range of degree of collateralization that occurs in the marketplace today, with on average for hedge fund counterparties, the amount of collateralization is roughly 160% of the exposure. And then when you're looking at governmental agencies, it's closer to 9 to 10% of the exposure. And based on recent surveys that ISTA has done, cash is used as a collateral 80% of the time for both collateral that's posted as well as collateral that's received. Government securities represent roughly 10% of collateral that's received and 17% of collateral that's delivered. So as we know, there's a lot of regulatory proposals that are out there currently that look to expand the role of central clearing organizations to reduce and reallocate counterparty risk and deal with liquidity risk. You know, as we look over the last 3 years or so, you know, the dominant types of derivatives in the OTC space are interest rate derivatives, and of that, it's interest rate swaps. And at this point in time, I think roughly 50% of interest rate swaps in the marketplace are actually cleared, and that's up from about 20% 3 years ago. And when you look at uncleared volume of interest rate swaps, that's declined 42% over that same time period. So there's a lot of change, a lot of dynamics that are going on, and that's just kind of at a high level. If you turn to slide three in the presentation materials that we handed out today, this just quickly touches upon the objectives, what we'd like to try and accomplish during the hour. I'd like to go through and illustrate the mechanics of collateral, the margin process, and other cash flows that are very common to derivative-type transactions. And we thought it would be helpful to present the information in Appendix A, which goes through the various types of major settlement platforms that are out there today, from the bilateral space to various clearing organizations, but to go through that in the context of a simple collateralized derivative portfolio. So that's what we have presented in the slides here. And then using that example, we'd like to highlight similarities and differences among the different settlement platforms. So that's really what we'd like to try and accomplish today. And what we're focused on is really business as usual. It's not in a default scenario. This is ongoing life of derivative portfolios that are performing. So if you turn to slide four, slides four and five, what we tried to do here is just provide, in plain English, some definitions that are key to the derivatives, understand the general background about derivatives portfolios and collateral mechanics. These definitions aren't based on legal definitions coming out of contracts, but it's more just a plain English articulation to facilitate an understanding. So going through very quickly, exposure, this is really looking, for example, in the bilateral space, you have a master netting arrangement, and you have a number of derivative contracts underneath that. And as you net that down to an exposure that might be a net asset or net liability relative to all the transactions underneath that, when we talk about a net exposure, that's generally what we're referring to. And that amount is then subjected to collateral calls. The concept of threshold, this is really in certain environments, especially in the bilateral space, depending on the type of counterparty and credit risk evaluations that are done, there may be thresholds that are set such that if the net open risk amount is below $500,000 at the end of the business day, there's not any cash collateral that moves. And so this may be, you know, for operational ease, or it may be because you have a very strong credit worthiness relative to the counterparty. collateral held. That's the current value of any collateral that's that you've received that's been posted to you. Minimum transfer amount, again, this kind of, I guess, ties in a bit with threshold. It's a threshold below which a collateral call would not be made. And I think this one is more focused from an operational type perspective. Arthur, I understand there's, some draft rules out there that are focused on this.
Yeah, it's probably just worth noting if you're following the CFTC NPRs that are out there, that they are proposing that between dealers and major swap participants, and between dealers and financial end users, which would include most hedge funds and fund managers, basically everyone but corporate end users, that they're going to require us to post collateral with each other, and they're going to require a zero minimum transfer amount and a minimum threshold. I think at the end of the day, the minimum threshold will probably stick. The minimum transfer amount will probably end up being something fairly small. If it's not zero, it'll be, a couple thousand dollars.
Can I ask a question on this page? This is Tatsumi speaking.
Go ahead.
Right. So the definition of the exposure, so it's subject to the collateral agreement. So that means the value of the collateral is not included in exposure, excluding. Is that?
Yes, that is correct. The definitions that we generally use are the exposure is the value of the underlying derivatives, and then we calculate the amount of collateral we would call for using the formula actually on the bottom of this page, the collateral call, which would take the exposure, the net exposure of the derivatives minus the threshold, which is the unsecured amount, minus the value of the collateral held less any applicable haircuts on that collateral. And that would give you the amount that of collateral that you could call for. And then so if there's a minimum transfer amount, it would be subject to that call.
So even in the cash collateral is not included in the exposure. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Great. And as you turn to slide 5, there's just a few more definitions here. Initial margin. This would be the margin that would be collected at the inception of transactions to cover the possibility of loss, to the extent that the daily margining process doesn't cover you and there's an event of default that happens intraday, risks of that sort, that's what the initial margin is there to protect against. Oftentimes, the amount of the initial margin, there's not necessarily a set formula. It's really based on what the credit executives deem appropriate based on the counterparty and the types of derivatives and so forth that would be within the relationship.
It's typically calculated either some percent of notional, if you want to make it very easy to calculate, and for more sophisticated counterparties, it's done using a portfolio-based value at risk type approach, looking for a certain number of days of coverage at a certain confidence level from market movements. So it can be calculated in many different ways, and it's negotiated bilaterally.
And so the target would be, what is your confidence level that you will be able to absorb losses over a given number of days? So, for instance, I could have a target of 99.9% confidence that I will have enough collateral to carry me over a period of, let's say, 5 days.
And the number of days is generally picked to sort of match the liquidation period that it would take to liquidate the portfolio in the event of the bankruptcy of the counterparty.
So it depends on the underlying asset. It may be that to liquidate a future, it would take me a different number of days than to liquidate a liquid interest rate swap versus a bespoke credit default swap.
And then the variation margin, that's margin that's frequently is collected on a daily basis. And as the fair value of the derivatives portfolio moves, and as there's settlements, coupon settlements that occur that create net open risk position or shifts the amount of net open risk, then the variation margin gets moved accordingly. The final term we have is coupon, and what we've used that to mean is really the contractual amounts that are due on the derivatives. That could be the payer, the net of the payer, the receive legs on an interest rate swap. It could be intrinsic value on an option or a forward contract that gets that's exercised or settled. So that's the coupon amount. Let's move to slide 6, which gets to the example, and I think these terms will come alive there.
Can I ask a simple question? So you're giving us the vocabulary to have this conversation. These strike me as terms that are relevant whether it's cleared or not cleared, and they are subject to negotiation between the parties.
Absolutely. So, for instance, initial margin IM would typically be used in a clearing context. The ISDA equivalent, the bilateral equivalent, would be independent amount, but the concept is the same. They are open to bilateral negotiation mostly in the bilateral world, the OTC world. In the clearing space, typically the clearinghouse calculates those amounts, and so there's less ability for the parties to negotiate that in a clearing environment.
I have one more question, and that was the statistics you gave before about the prevalence of posting collateral, is that including both bilateral arrangements and clearing arrangements?
It is, yes.
Thanks.
I thought that was just unclear.
That's primarily unclear.
Because I got that from the
ISDA survey.
The ISDA survey with the $600 trillion notional, I think.
Yeah, they do have some sections on unclear, but the collateral comments were generally on the unclear side.
Okay. Right, I apologize.
Yeah, the source document, and it's posted on the ISDA website, is the 2011 ISDA survey that was released in April.
And we can send that along, but it breaks down. Within that population of $600 trillion, there's roughly $400 million of interest rate contracts. Half of that is on LCH, roughly.
Yeah, because everything on LCH is collateralized.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
By definition.
Exactly. My assumption was that because LCH was in there, that included the cleared activity as well.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And just to further talk about the terms here, they're defined in different places for different rules. So if it's a CFTC-regulated clearinghouse, there are actually definitions for some of these terms actually sitting in the regulations that are promulgated by the CFTC. Some of these terms are like exposure documented in the ISDA agreement or the CSA agreement. Threshold is only used in the bilateral space. Minimum transfer amount is only used in the bilateral space.
I guess it also depends on the legal structure of different clearing contexts. So, for instance, in the UK, the legal structure is based on ISDA infrastructure. So, even though you have a clearing house involved, the documents supporting that would be ISDA documents. So, you would see that when we have a relationship with the client, we would have an ISDA master that would have a minimum transfer and a threshold. But then we would take that collateral and then post it to the clearinghouse. So it could be both. Okay, great. We'd like to turn to slide 6.
Leslie, could I just ask, before we get too far in, there's quite a lot of acronyms flying about. Could we just sort of give us the full titles? Just, it's hard as I pick them up. If I missed them first time round, I've lost it.
Okay, NPR is a notice of proposed rulemaking. That one struck me.
Sorry about that.
Feel free to stop us, and we'll be happy to talk about
Which other ones did we use?
We used CFTC.
Commodities and Futures Trade Commission.
Which is the rulemaking body for effectively for cleared derivatives in the U.S.
We may also talk about the SEC. I think that works. So in the U.S. now, just to level set, in the United States for cleared swaps, now the two authorities are the CFTC for what is now a technical term that means swaps, and the SEC for security-based swaps. So the CFTC is the relevant authority for swaps that includes interest rate swaps, indices of credit default swaps and equity derivatives, and then also commodities and FX to the extent they're covered. Instead, security-based swaps would cover single-name credit default swaps, single-name equity derivatives, and the SEC is the authority that's relevant for security-based swaps.
Is it worth pointing out for unclear derivatives that there's a little different coverage with like the Fed has some coverage for those?
Right. So the Fed is also involved. Is a obviously a relevant regulator in CLEAR because they regulate most banking institutions. And then also for CLEAR transactions, there's a mechanism for a council of regulators in the United States to designate clearinghouses that are systemically important. Once a clearinghouse is designated as systemically important, then the Fed, together with the CFTC and the SEC, will have oversight of those institutions because, amongst other things, those institutions will have access to discount window in certain situations.
And then I'd say on the uncleared side, the Dodd-Frank Act also has rules about or ideas about collateral that the regulators are picking up. And so the CFTC will regulate those entities that are not regulated by the Fed, and the Fed has issued draft rules that are slightly different than the CFTC's for the uncleared margin on uncleared derivatives.
Okay. So that's great background. So I think we'll move on to the example on slide 6, and it should help to illuminate some of the terminology that we had on slides 4 and 5, but certainly stop if there's any acronyms that we're throwing about. So the example we have on slide 6 is an OTC derivative example, and I would say it really speaks to the bottom row in Appendix A, this in Agenda Paper 1B. So this is covering a bilateral example, but I think it'll hopefully be instructive as we then work our way through Appendix A to compare and contrast versus the other settlement platforms. So in the OTC bilateral space, this covers a variety of types of derivatives from swaps, options, forwards, and different market risks, foreign currency, interest rate, and so forth. The example that we've prepared here has Bank A that's executed a ISDA master netting arrangement and a CSA, a credit support annex, with a hedge fund B in this example. And this is this example, payment netting is not did so. Even though certain cash flows, gross cash flows may be due, payable as well as receivable by Bank A on the same day, those cash flows will still go gross. They won't be netted down in this example. And so what we've done is we've assumed as of the 29th of June that there's as of the closing on the 29th of June, there's a certain position that exists, and this has been built up over time. It's been built up over years, a portfolio of derivatives, and the fair value of those positions at the end of the 29th of June would be the gross asset fair value is $60 million, and the gross liability fair value is $55 million. So you've got hundreds or thousands of swaps that are underneath this master netting arrangement. And so at the close of business, June 29th, there's an exposure amount, a net amount of $5 million, a net asset of $5 million, and that's really the credit exposure that exists at that point in time. Within this example, we have various derivative settlements that occur on June 30th, and so those are, in our vernacular, coupon payments that will be receivable, received, $125 million of coupon payments that are received, and then there will also be $200 million of coupon payments that are made on the 30th of June. But we're holding everything else constant on the 30th of June. We're not having any fair value fluctuations in the existing derivatives portfolio there. Then on the 1st of July, we're having a mark-to-market fluctuation that occurs whereby the derivative assets increase in value by $1 million. The liabilities stay constant, and there's no coupon payments. Not a realistic example from that standpoint, because really all these variables will be moving every day, but what we're trying to do is illustrate and isolate the different types of cash flows that would occur on derivatives portfolio, and then you can see how that translates into payments that get made or received, and then how the variation margin circles right back the following day. We've also, within this example, assumed that Bank A has received initial margin of $250,000 that was paid by hedge fund B. And cash variation margin will be provided on a daily basis for the full net derivative position.
So, Dan, a quick question. When I look at the June 30 transaction, the net is a $5 million going one way when I take consideration the coupon payments, the collateral call, and then the interest. Why economically does the cash go gross?
Yeah, and it should let. Yeah, well, it's really operationally, I think, is why the cash goes gross,
But it's also an election of the counterparty as well. So in this example, the counterparty is not elected payment netting.
Right. So that, I'm trying to understand why
doesn't happen very often.
Right.
Most
right.
of the counterparties have elected payment netting. What happened is back in the late 80s, everyone was doing everything gross. And when ISDA put in the provision or the option to do payment netting, because people were operationally netting and the lawyers decided they ought to provide some protection that if we're settling in net that there's legal cover for that, they put that in the agreements, and then the banks, working with their counterparties, slowly worked that into every agreement throughout the 90s. So most agreements now have payment netting of coupons. So the coupon column, where it says, 125 in and 200 out, if those are in the same currency, if this is a pure U.S. dollar interest rate swap portfolio, and that's all you, therefore everything is U.S. dollars, not necessarily U.S. dollar equivalent, what would settle is $75,000 outflow. That would be the only movement that would happen on the coupon side. If this were a multi-currency portfolio, then you'd have a movement in each currency. You have one movement per currency because you net by currency within the portfolio. And frequently, for operational reasons, you net by asset class. Many counterparties do not have the operational capability to net cash flows, let's say, between CDS, or credit derivatives, credit default swaps, and interest rate swaps, for example. Some do, some don't. And so that doesn't always happen. The legal agreements allow for it if you can do it. The interest on collateral, which is the piece on the side, the reason why that doesn't typically go is that's a once-a-month calculation, the interest movement, and since we picked a month end for the example, we put it in here. And just for ease of keeping track of it, accounting for it, we keep it separate and watching it move through the accounts. It could be netted with the coupon cash flows pretty easily. The collateral flows, we'll wait until we go through the example. You'll see why those are slightly different.
Yep. Yeah, and just to add one more point, just so it's clear, the interest component, yes, agreed, it's a monthly. Obviously, calculated daily, right? So it's accruing daily.
Yes.
And then at the end of the month, brought all together, agreed and paid.
There's a legal consideration that I'd like to point out here. I think it's key from a legal point to stress the difference between payment netting and closeout netting. So I just wanted to spend less than a minute talking about that. I think it's a really key issue here. In the legal analysis, we distinguish between when the patient is healthy and when the patient is not healthy. So payment netting for us is the patient is healthy. And so we take a slightly more relaxed approach because we, if it is possible for ease to facilitate the flows, we will say, okay, if I owe you 5 and you owe me 10, we will net those off. And that's basically payment netting. It's for convenience. But what we really care about from a legal point of view is when the patient is not well. So when the counterparty is about to go into a situation that will mean that they will have less assets than liabilities, then we care about netting, and we call that close-out netting, which is the reason why all of the legal opinions that we get are on close-out netting, not really on payment netting, because the patient is healthy when we do payment netting. So closeout netting means that we look at all of these cash flows, and irrespective of whether when the patient is healthy for convenience, we allow them to be net off or not, when the patient is not healthy, we say, okay, we take everything I owe you and everything you owe me, and we net those out against each other, which is why when we get legal opinions, they are conditional on there being an event of default. But that, in our mind, from a legal point of view, isn't really a condition because that's when we care about netting and set, which is sort of a set off is one step further than netting, and we can talk about that if there are questions. Thank you.
So building on the example that Dan laid out on slide 6, let's look at slide 6 and slide 7 together, which are slide 7 is an attempt to show visually the relationship between the derivative cash flows that make up the derivative asset, that unit of account basis, derivative asset and derivative liability, the relationship between the cash flows that make up those amounts and then the collateral cash flows that are directly related to them. So slide 7 shows a timeline over 4 days that shows what happens to this derivative portfolio that Dan laid out here. As a starting point, we're going to assume that the unrealized gain as of June 29th has been fully collected in cash. We're not going to focus on the timing of that collection at the moment. We just want a very clean starting point so we can evaluate what happens on June 30th and just make that much simpler to look at. So assume that that $5 million has been collected in cash from hedge fund B and it's being held right now by bank A. We're also, for the moment, even though we show them here on slide 7, going to ignore for the moment the initial margin receipt and the interest payments on collateral. We just want to focus right now on the coupon payments and then what happens in the collateral process. So if you look at slide 7, it's broken up by this timeline arrow going across between the top half of the page, which shows the derivative events, and then the bottom half of the page underneath that timeline arrow showing the collateral events that are related to those derivative events. So if you look at June 30th, you see a coupon receipt. This is from Bank A's perspective. A coupon receipt of $125,000 and a coupon payment of $200,000. As Arthur has discussed, if this were an interest rate swap portfolio, that receipt and payment would be settled net of $75,000. So in this portfolio that we're going through, the fact that they are not payment netting these two amounts, perhaps it's an interest rate swap and a credit default swap coupon settling separately across those two platforms that can't operationally speak to each other. So on June 30th, Bank A pays $125,000 to hedge fund B, receives $125,000 from hedge fund B, and Bank A pays $200,000 to hedge fund B for a net cash flow between the two parties of Bank A paying $75,000. You can see the impact back on slide 6 of this receipt and payment. You can see the gross impact of the $125,000 takes the June 29th asset fair value of $60 million down to, on June 30th, $59,875. That's the $125 there. Under the liability fair value, you see the impact of the $200,000 payment taking the $55 million down to $54,800. After those cash payments are made at the end of the day on June 30th, you would have to recalculate your credit exposure. And in this example, we're assuming that there's no other fair value changes on June 30th. But you can see just the cash flows themselves cause a change in the credit exposure between the two counterparties that the collateral agreement, that credit support annex referred to on the top of slide 6, is intended to manage. So on June 30th, you calculate your new net exposure. That would be the $59,875 minus the $54,800, and you come up to a net exposure of $5,075. Now, in our example, our previous day's exposure was $5 million, and we are saying that we had already collected that $5 million. So you take in the equation in our definition slide, the exposure minus the collateral held, that would be $5,075 minus the $5 million gives you a collateral call of $75. So on July 1st, Bank A would call for collateral of $75,000 to hedge fund B. In our example, that would be received at the end of the day on July 1st. So net-net, what's happened here is on June 30th, Bank A has paid $75,000 to hedge fund B, and on July 1st, hedge fund B has to pay back that $75,000 to Bank A. Now, if you think about relating the cash flows that you see here visually on slide 7 to the balance sheet amounts, the things above the line are the derivative assets and liabilities, which we're focused on whether they should be presented gross or net. Focusing on that presentation of gross or net, you want to make sure that you don't miss what happens below the line, which return those same cash flows that we're concerned about representing appropriately. So that 75 above the line is returned the next day through the collateral process. And note that that 75 in the collateral process, it's made up of a 125 and a 200. So when you consider how the collateral should be presented, one thing that should be considered is whether you should consider representing the 75 or representing its components gross, just like everything that's above the line. So that's why in the different views that are looked at, people talk about netting the derivative asset, which equates to the coupon receipt here, the derivative liability, which equates to the coupon payment here, that 125 and 200, netting all three of those, the 125, 200, and then that 75 below the line. Are there any questions about that?
Any questions on the example?
Yeah. Now might be a good time to turn it over to Arthur, who can talk in a little more realistic detail about how the collateral process works between the collection of the cash flows on the end of June 30th and the ultimate collection of the collateral on the end of July 1st.
Sure. So what happens, as Lauren pointed out, is that the on June 30th, the coupon payments came in. Every night in most swap dealers, there's a feed from these swap systems into a system that does the valuation, and the valuations are run overnight. So first thing in the morning the next day, we know what the valuation of the exposure number is that we're looking at collateralize. We also get feeds from custodians for any non-cash collateral. We obviously know what cash collateral we have. And we can use the formula that was given earlier to calculate what margin call we're allowed to call. For hedge fund clients, we've typically negotiated, and it's a market practice, if you make the call before a certain time, typically 10 a.m. Local time, the counterparty has to pay you the same day the margin, which is why in this example we're assuming we've made the call before 10 a.m. on July 1st, and that the margin will come in at the end of the day, at the end of the day. For other types of counterparties, particularly, let's say, banks, typically you do a collateral call on July 1st, and the payment would happen on July 2nd, typically T plus one settlement instead of same day. The other thing is sometimes for particularly large movements, and that can occur, let's say, if there's an unwind payment in there. So someone unwound a large swap, or there's an assignment of some kind, so the large movement related to the derivative event, we will typically work with the counterparty to actually net the collateral movement with the movement of the underlying the settlement on the derivative event. And the reason we would do that is it could be a very large liquidity event. So you can imagine, for example, a case where we are receiving from the counterparty, let's say $10 million on an unwind event on June 30th, and then the next day we're going to send them $10 million as we return collateral to them. And that creates liquidity where the counterparty would actually have to have liquidity overnight, and in order to accommodate the client's needs, we would actually look to net those together. There's a lot of discussion actually in the industry to figure out how we can do that on an operational basis going forward so that we can actually merge these payments together and actually bring them together. So that's something that we've been discussing. And obviously when you move to the cleared example, you get that de facto. You don't even have to think about it because that does net it on the same day.
Arthur, can I just ask you, what was the context of the last comment you made where you said there's a movement to try and operationalize that netting for what exact transactions again?
For any type of transaction, we're trying to bring these flows to the same day. So we've just shown you an example, which is how it would work today with a hedge fund, where there's a one-day difference between the derivative event cash movement and the collateral cash movement. And people are trying to move them together for operation, for basically liquidity reasons. to move them to the same day, because that would operationally simplify things and make things easier from a liquidity point of view for one day.
Another way of saying that is you're trying to include the collateral payment within the payment netting.
Operationally, yes. I'll leave it to a lawyer to say if we're legally doing that.
Yeah, so from a legal point of view, again, if the patient is healthy, we will try to accommodate the client. And so the cash flows under the derivative would be paid back and forth and subject to payment netting if that's what we have agreed. We can also agree to say, to look at, on one hand, the cash flows on the derivative coming back and forth, and then on the other, cash flows on the collateral, and agree with the client that we will net one against the other. From a legal point of view, there's a difference in that when we receive or pay collateral, we are taking a security interest or transferring title in that collateral. So in some cases, we agree with the client that in order to do that, we will receive a cash flow from the client and we will post to ourselves on behalf of the client, just so that we can satisfy the legal requirement that we either post collateral to the client or receive collateral from the client. So all that is necessary from a legal point of view is to agree with the client that we can net those two flows. And again, in a closeout situation, you will definitely look at all of the flows, stop everything, look at everything that is owed to me, everything that I owe to the counterparty, and really net those out against each other.
So if you were able to operationalize that, do you think you would meet the criteria that we had in the exposure draft, or from a legal standpoint, would you still not meet it because it's conditional?
I would still not meet it because it's conditional. From a legal point of view, I have difficulties understanding the requirement for no condition, because the whole structure that we have, and we have a very well-developed infrastructure for reviewing legal opinions on netting and collateral, and we have confidence factors for a variety of jurisdictions and a variety of types of counterparties, so financial entities, hedge funds, and so forth. And all that we care about is in a default situation. So it is a condition, but it's the only situation in which it really matters for us. So it was difficult for us to reconcile our legal analysis and our infrastructure with the exposure draft.
Okay.
So can I ask a question?
Sure.
Just on exactly that point, the problem we had with the exposure draft was the case of someone paying before another one, and then you had this German bank that went bust, and suddenly all those who'd paid earlier couldn't get their money back. So this is why it's very important, I think, that the collateral, we could get some operationality, so you actually netted off all three, the payments either way plus the collateral. That would be simultaneous, and then the next legal issue is, does the title of the collateral pass at that moment? Because then it would all be netted in. But you're still exposed for 24 hours under this model.
From a legal point of view, when we look at the situation in a default, we look at the various jurisdictions, and often there are rules about making a payment to someone that you know is about to go into a default. So when we obtain legal opinions, they are based on the condition that a default would happen, but we also ask, are there rules that relate to, for instance, clawbacks? So over X number of days prior to the default, if I made payments to someone that I know is going to be in default, or if I receive those payments may be clawed back, which means they go back into the entity that made those payments so that they can be shared equally amongst creditors. So my point is that even though our legal opinions are conditional on a default, again, the issue of payments made just before the default would typically be covered in the opinions that we obtain in the various jurisdictions.
And I might also highlight, if you turn to slide 8, this is really a snapshot of the balance sheet at the end of each day in this example that we've walked through. And this is based on a U.S. GAAP current presentation that we have today. And so you can see the end of June 29, the net reported position would be zero, netting down the derivative assets, derivative liabilities, and the collateral that's been posted cumulatively life to date on the portfolio. At June 30th, that's the day when we had the coupon receipts and payments that occurred that increased the net exposure to $75,000. And so when you close the books at the end of that day, there is an asset that gets presented there on the balance sheet, on the face. So that exposure is clearly represented as an asset. And we do have initial margin as well over and above what Alessandro just talked about. There's initial margin to cover that credit exposure as well. And then July 1st, we see, based on the fair value movements on July 1st, we've received $75,000 of the collateral variation margin, but we've had an appreciation in the portfolio of $1 million. And again, that exposure, that credit risk amount, if you will, of $1 million is reflected on the balance sheet.
So that one day left is always reflected on the balance sheet. Forgive me.
It's Rory Cunningham, LCH. I didn't want to interfere with your flow, which is excellent presentation, or complicate matters. Just wanted to perhaps get out on the table that for the CCP collateralization and clearing with its counterparties, which are the banks, and not hedge funds directly, we do maximize the netting and net off the coupon flows and the margin calls into a single payment as a matter of course in all currencies. That's only handling interest rate swaps, though, so it's only ask. But to say we do maximize in the clearing process, and other CCPs would try and do the same to the extent they can.
Yeah, Roy, that's a good segue into slide 9, which is probably a good opportunity to start comparing and contrasting the example we had for biologicals with that of clear. And I think Roy raises a good point, in that these flows that we speak of that are gross exchanged in the bilateral are oftentimes net exchanged with the CCP.
And if we can just stay in the bilateral for one second, I just want to make sure it's clear that while there may be an exposure because of that one-day lag, the point of slide 8 is to show that one day's exposure is represented on the balance sheet when you have it. You see that exposure, and so it's not hidden. You see that $75,000 that you are exposed to at that point in time, even through the current U.S. GAAP presentation.
So until such time that you get the collateral in the door, you've got that exposure recognized on your balance sheet. Okay, so slide 9, I think. Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask about that one-day exposure. I mean, we prepare balance sheets that show assets and liabilities, and what we're trying to do is determine whether we have one single asset or two items, an asset or a liability. And the fact that the net exposure is presented on the balance sheet doesn't necessarily, at least to me, mean that we only have some net asset or liability, but our issue is to try to identify whether we've got two separate things here. And we allow netting only sort of as a convenience in defining what is an asset. I don't know if I'm making my point very well, but the notion of simultaneous settlement, for example, for us is just a convenience in trying to figure out, do we have two things or one separate thing? So the fact that you're showing the 75 as a net item doesn't necessarily mean, from an accounting perspective, we've only got one net item.
And we weren't intending to speak to that. What we were intending to speak to here by showing that balance sheet as of June 30th is to show the fact that the concern about the 75 going out the door and a default situation occurring at that moment and not getting that 75 back, to address the concern that the exposure to that 75 wasn't apparent by looking at the financial reporting. And what we're trying to say is that it is.
And that really the derivatives portfolio, the banks manage on a net open position. And so the cash flows that actually paid or received are based on the net open position. not on the gross position.
Right, not on individual confirmations underneath that master netting agreement.
And sorry, just from a legal point of view, that's a very important point for us, because the ISDA master agreement, together with all of the transactions and all of the collateral, is one legal agreement, and it's the first thing that the ISDA master agreement says on page one. This is a single agreement, which is a very important concept for the legal analysis from a netting and set-off enforceability point of view. Again, the idea is that the various transactions, the various derivatives, and the various movements of collateral are all part of one single relationship between the two parties. And so in a default, again, all of those are entries that are used to calculate one single net sum that is owed by one party to the other.
There are two issues that we're discussing today.
Can I ask a question? Going back to your slide, I think slide number, I'm trying to find the balance sheet table. Slide number eight. The problem is not so much what you show on June 30th. Obviously, June 30th, you have exposure of 75. But what you're saying at June 29th is that your exposure is zero. And there's not been any fair value changes, no market movements. There have been payments, but no market movements. So the next day, you're saying, well, I have the same instruments, no market movements. My exposure is now 75. So what you said on 29th is not consistent with what you're saying on 30th of June. And that's what the problem is, because you're not taking maturity into account. And hence, what you're saying at 29th is a bit misleading, because that's not what your exposure is going forward.
Yeah, we don't agree with that, Christian, because the cash flows haven't changed your credit exposure yet. The cash flows occur on June 30th, and therefore your credit exposure hasn't changed. If there's a default event on June 29th, you don't have a credit exposure. The enforceability of that contract would allow you to have a flat net position. We had thought that your concern was that if the default event occurs on June 30th, that we would be exposed to that 75, and that 75 would not be apparent to those looking at the financial statements. And what we're trying to show is that it is. If your point is not that, and your point is that looking at the balance sheet on June 29th won't show you that cash flows are going to occur on June 30th that will change your credit exposure, we're not sure that that's intended to be reflected there.
But I think the problem is that at the date of the balance sheet, you know, as a reader or user of the financial statements, you're not concerned about the date that the financial statements are prepared. You're looking forward into the future to see what the exposure is going forward. And here on the 29th, you're saying that my exposure is zero, but it's not actually zero going forward. Even if market factors don't change, your exposure the next day will turn out to be 75 with the same identical instruments. And so you're misleading if you say that your exposure is zero at 29th. That's what the problem is, in addition to the point that you have a day lag or even 2 days for variation margin to come back.
The coupon payments do change the fair value of the contracts, right? And so maybe the market underlier has not changed, but the coupon payments, cash flows come in or go out, that clearly changes the fair value of the derivatives, and therefore, and that's reflected as such. How will gross presentation provide any more information that you're looking for?
Well, and actually, the question to Christian should be, do you think showing a separate derivative asset of $60 million there gives a better indication of what your exposure is than the net of zero? Because the only change of 75 on June 30th is a function of cash flows that actually occurred on that day.
Yes.
So which is more representationally faithful? That's the question.
But I think it is more, if you look at the gross presentation, at least you know what your total asset position is, what your total liability exposure or your exposure is for the derivative liabilities that you have. Whereas when you net down and you ignore maturity, what you're saying is that my exposure is nil, but it is not nil. The very next day, because of the payment flows, your exposure will then change. You're talking about 75 million here. It can run into hundreds of millions because the amount could be really huge. And also, there is a time lag. It's not only one day. It depends on efficiency of the parties. If you, as we said, if you forget to call for variation margin 10 a.m., then you have to wait for 2 days before you even get a variation margin back. It's not automatic. So your exposure is really huge.
Christian, we're here to explain collateral flows, not to argue the merits of the presentation.
Okay, in that spirit, looking at the clock, I know you had a little bit more to go through. I know I have a question. What's that?
We should touch on slide 9 to at least identify. Now, we've talked OTC for an hour. I think it's probably worthwhile spending a few minutes in talking about Clear and explaining how those same cash flows. We'll try to be very, very I think the table of Appendix A does a great job of highlighting that. And so we may want to point out a few things, and maybe we'll start with actually LCH and CME would be a good place. There, as we talked in the bilateral, the three separate flows, were coupon, margin, and initial margin. Those are all a single flow under the LCH and CME platforms. And those occur daily. And again, though, it is net by currency. So it is going to be grossed up based on different currencies that we're going to flow. Now, we've got on the slide also ICE Trust and ICE Clear, which indicates that those are separate flows for coupon and for margin and interest. That's only true for about another month or so. Those are in the process of being changed such that they will also be net for all. So it will look like LCH and CME.
May I just add from a legal point of view,
please.
Under the settlement mechanism column that we've just been talking about, this would be the equivalent, if we compare clearing with OTC bilateral, this would be the equivalent of saying payment net. Because this is what happens during the life of the transaction when the client is healthy. In terms of on default, then the ISDA and all of the clearing houses would essentially say the same thing. You calculate everything that I owe to the client and everything the client owes me, and we calculate one net sum that moves when it really matters, which is on a default.
Correct. So upon default, they all act the same. All assets, liabilities that you might think of as separate collapse into one, and there's one settlement amount.
I have a question about the legalities of the clearing systems. I think our focus in distinguishing the clearing systems from the bilateral agreements has been on whether the cash flows will be settled net and whether provisions have been set up to do so. But a point you made earlier, Alessandro, about whether the agreements are enforceable only in a default situation or in the normal course of business has me curious about whether the legalities of a clearing system are actually different from a bilateral agreement. In other words, when you were talking about the ability to get an opinion on the payment netting situation, is it any different for a clearing system?
Not really. It is not different. And that's because the legislation itself, so the opinion would be an opinion that says, in looking at the law of this country, England, the U.S., another country, your set-off and netting will be enforceable. And then they say, in a default situation, and the reason they say that is not that they establish a condition, it's that the laws themselves are written to cover a default situation. Because again, from a legal point of view, that's the only thing that matters. Not the day-to-day, but when you have a default, is it going to work? So the legal opinions for both the bilateral and the clearing infrastructure, and of course IOSCO requires legal opinions for clearing, they only talk about netting in a default situation because the laws are written that way.
Yeah. Can I clarify one thing? The point that you were making earlier about undue preferences, so making a payment knowing that somebody's about to go into default and the risk of that payment being clawed back, is that not an analysis based on considering the risk of default?
Yes, absolutely. So again, the whole analysis would be based on a default situation. And so if you have a default situation, again, sort of, you could say it's conditional on default. How far do you look back to see whether you would claw back any payments that have been made?
We have some background material of papers for today that talk about applying what the conditions are in the exposure draft to contemplating what the effects of collateral would be on rights of offset and perhaps notions of settlement. And it discusses that initial margin is never going to meet the conditions within the exposure draft for set-off. Perhaps variation margin or intraday margin might. And it also discusses that perhaps that variation margin or intraday margin may actually qualify constructively or actually legally as settlement. Could you tell me a little bit more about the possibilities that intraday margin or variation margin might qualify as settlement? Because I think that's beyond what we're talking about in this particular set-off circumstance, because if it's settlement, it could be viewed to be derecognition. Yep. So could you give me a little bit more context as to when and in what circumstances variation or intraday margin would be thought to be legal settlement? Is that frequent, infrequent?
So, again, this is where the language is slightly different between the accounting and the legal, and I spent a lot of time with my colleagues in accounting talking about this question. And I struggle with this question, to be honest, because from an economic and legal point of view, settlement on one hand and collateral on the other, in my world, are not that different, meaning that I have a live transaction, be it a future or an OTC derivative, and I know that I'm making a payment today. Now, we can call that payment settlement for futures and say we're done, but we know that we're not done because tomorrow when we come into the office, I may have to make another margin payment to you. That is not different, in my mind, from a legal point of view and an economic point of view, from an OTC derivative where we say that I transfer this to you as collateral, but for instance, under English law, I transfer title to that asset to you, and so it's yours. And if I go into default overnight, you can stop all payments and say, I have this collateral, I'm keeping it. In my mind, that is the same as settlement. And the day after, just like in a future, we come into work, and if the position has moved, I have to post more collateral to you or vice versa. And the situation under English law is not different from New York law, because under New York law we have a pledge, but the rights associated with that pledge are so broad that it's essentially the same as title transfer. So I'm not sure I answer your question, but from a legal point of view, I always struggle with this because I don't think the two should be treated differently in that in a futures, in an OTC, we exchange collateral flows today, we're done at the end of the day, and the position still moves tomorrow. So so I don't think there's any difference from a legal and economic point of view.
So economically, I would say that there is different treatment currently. I'd say futures is Alessandro highlighted. Under futures, that variation margin is recognized as settlement.
Because of the notion in your Appendix A that in a clearing environment or futures environment, it's a single process.
Well, not so much because it's a single process. Really, if you look at, we highlight, say, futures that are cleared, right? That's the top row.
There is?
Right. It's, for the most part, it's recognized as settlement, the exchange of variation margin. Now, there is a question out there, which Alessandra's been trying to deal with, is, well, what about in this mixed attribute model, where this cleared world, it's not exchange traded, but it's cleared, how do you think about variation margin? His view economically, what's the difference? You've received it. It's yours when bad things happen. It's in the events that we care about upon default, it's yours.
And is that the point? In other words, it's settlement when it's default. But prior to default, it's not really settlement because you've got to give it back. Although
economically, you can
consider it settlement. I can understand how you consider
really don't
settlement.
Have to.
I mean, there's a couple of...
It's not really settlement until it's default.
Right, but if we... So if I pay to you and then I go into a default, when it matters, it's yours. You keep it. So again, in my mind, it is the same as saying that it's settlement because I will not get it back if I go into a default. You can keep it. That's the whole point. And also, if I just want
to... There are a couple of differences I want to highlight. The first one is that when you have the collateral system, especially where it's not combined as a single process, it doesn't mean that you don't have any obligations under the underlying contracts. You still have to fulfill your obligations under the underlying contracts. You have to continue to pay and still post collateral separately. And hence, it's not settlement. It doesn't extinguish your obligations under the contract, although you can say, well, if you don't pay me, then I can offset the collateral against the amount that I have to pay you. But legally, the two are separate, and you still have an obligation, an ongoing obligation, to continue to pay for the contracts that you have. Whereas if it's actually a legal settlement, you cannot be asked to pay more than you've paid. So there is a slight difference there economically because there's a liquidity issue as well. You have to continue to settle the underlying contracts and continue to post collateral, which can place a huge burden on the entity. But the second one is a point you raised earlier on, which is the difference between what happens on our CCPs and on the OTC market. What is the right of the party that is receiving the collateral? And you mentioned that, and that's an answer to Leslie's point. As you said, you have to treat the collateral in a particular way to be able to offset the collateral against the coupons that are due on a particular date. Whereas on the CCP, you don't have to do that. They do have the right today to do it, and legally it's respected. Can you touch on that a bit?
So just on your first point, you mentioned that there's a difference between settlement and collateral, because in settlement, if I understand correctly, you mentioned that once it's settled, I don't have to pay anymore. But I have a slightly different view, because if we have a future position that is open, we settle today, but if it moves tomorrow, if the markets move tomorrow, I'm going to have to post more collateral, or I will call for more collateral. So that's why from a legal and economic point of view, there's no difference between the two instruments. A future on one hand that we call settlement, and an OTC cleared or uncleared on the other hand that we call collateral. In both circumstances, I pay something today. If I go into default overnight, you can keep it. And then tomorrow the position is live again, both for futures and for OTC. If it moves again, we're going to have to exchange collateral again. And the second point, sorry, now I forgot the second point. Could you mention that again, please?
Yeah, the second point, I think David was trying to find out what prevents you from offsetting the coupons against the collateral. And you said legally there are some steps that you need to, additional steps you need to take to be able to do that. Whereas on the CCP world, you don't have to do anything else. They can offset it straight away. Is there any legal issues there?
Right. So, again, let's distinguish payment netting from default netting. So, under payment netting, if I let's say that we have a legal structure where I have to pledge something to you, we have to recognize the fact that that has happened. So, if instead of I delivering money to you, you say this amount that you would pay me, then instead of you paying it to me, you pay $5 to me, I pay $5 back to you, and you use that $5 as if I gave it to you as a pledge. For us to say, instead of doing that return trip for that $5, we just treat it as if you gave it to me, I gave it back to you as collateral. So that's all that it is. We need to clarify that if we net that amount for purposes of taking collateral, it has to be recognized that we're doing it for that purpose, because collateral is treated in a special way and it has some particular regard in the eye of the law. But in default, again, when it really matters, bilateral OTC or cleared OTC or futures, it all works the same way, meaning that everything stops and we calculate everything I owe you and everything you owe me, again, when it matters, and it's one net sum.
But, Christian, is your question around the central clearing like LCH and such that when an entity such as Deutsche Bank signs up to be a clearing member at LCH, what I sign up as a part of a contractual agreement is that I agree everything related to these instruments will be settled net every day, and I will provide variation margin to cover an amount, or I will receive variation margin to cover an amount. And because I am that clearing member and I've agreed to that, I am held to that, and I have no way of changing that unless I agree not to clear my derivatives through that exchange. Is that?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. That there's a difference between that and the OTC world, where, according to what he's saying, you need to deem something to be something else before you can offset a coupon and the variation margin. Whereas, as we said, if you already agree to it with a CCP, you have no choice. That is what is going to happen.
But there is a comparable in the OTC world around the payment netting, where counterparties can agree through payment netting that they will then start to net payments in the same way that you do it on an exchange, which is the same legal binding you have to abide by it if you agree to do it.
But the variation margin in your bilateral world doesn't cover those payments, those payment netting amounts.
Currently,
so just to clarify, in the legal structure, in the legal structure, if you agree to it, which you can do, then the two will work exactly the same way. And if I may, I just wanted to mention that the importance of initial margin. So to the extent that you can recognize initial margin, of course, we spend a lot of time commenting, for instance, on the IOSCO paper, on the CPSS IOSCO paper, on what should be the right amount of initial margin. So in the clearing community and the bilateral community, initial margin is an extremely important concept. So to the extent there is a way from an accounting perspective to recognize that it is there, I think it would be important because it is a key feature of the financial stability of both cleared and unclear transactions.
So I think that, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I want to just clarify one point. I think one of the things you see difference from the exchanges is the one net cash flow, and you're concerned in the OTC world of what you're hearing is there may be more than one cash flow happening in a single day. But I think, I'm not sure who mentioned it, but you're talking about operationally within an institution being able to bring together what an exchange has been set up to bring together. And in a lot of our institutions, there's an issue, if there are different systems that don't talk to each other, then it is very difficult operationally to get down to that one net cash flow.
That's right.
But it doesn't mean that these aren't happening the same day.
As you move across the different settlement platforms within Appendix A, from bilateral and across the various clearing organizations, we think the differences from a risk perspective are very slight. From a credit risk, from a liquidity risk perspective, I think it is really very slight. And what you have are different processes, different legal forms and operational processes that occur. But importantly, from a credit and liquidity perspective, we think it's very slight differences as you move through Appendix A.
And just one quick question. Do you see over time these converging, or do these exchanges view these differences as competitive advantages?
I would say that I do see them converging, honestly. I think, and even Arthur made the point earlier, I think you'll even start to see the convergence with the whatever's left in the bilateral space, honestly, with some of the things that we've talked about with the, even they're trying to net down the variation margin, initial margin payments with the settlement. You are seeing that happen in pockets and where it's significant amounts. We're trying to work as an industry to figure out how we can do that more frequently, which then starts to exactly mirror what you're seeing on the CCPs and the exchange. I think also Dodd-Frank starts to bring into some of those points as well to really start to drive that convergence together, honestly.
I would actually argue history would support that comment. I mean, if you look at the OTC derivative space, it started divergently and it moved convergently as people started thinking about how to make it operationally simpler to reduce costs and whatnot. And so as you have multiple clearinghouses all doing roughly the same thing, people are going to want to create operational simplicity, and they're going to want the same type of processes.
And there's industry forums that I think, amongst operations professionals, where that's already happening today, across CCPs, where we're asking questions to the various folks, why is this different here, why is this different there? We'd like to see it the same way.
Because you don't want to build more than one flow if you don't have to, right? So the banks don't want multiple pipes to deal with multiple.
I just didn't know if any of
could I market. Could I just come in? Sorry, no. Sorry guys, it's Rory. Could I just come in? Just to support what you're saying, because I happen to sit in both the CCP12 group with the CME and also European group, and we are working, as you say. I know we're very much over time. I just wanted to mention three quick things quickly. Going back to discussion about daily settlement of futures contracts, and yet they're still being the requirement to recollateralize the next day. Many years ago, I was involved in setting up the life market in London, and the structure put in place then, and I have to check whether it's still exactly the same, is that every day there's a new contract. The contract is marked to market, variation margin is called and paid, and then a new contract is opened, and then that effectively lasts another day. Now, whether that is exactly the same as the current structures, I cannot say, but that is certainly the way it was originally designed. And therefore, rather than having one futures contract lasting how many months, you have a series of daily contracts bolted onto each other. A point about variation margin, of course, the summary here is fine. I would just say that most of the discussion today has been around interest rate swaps. There are certain forms of derivatives that we clear OTC and exchange where the variation margin process is not handled in cash, but we will take collateral from the side to whom we have the exposure, and the other side has an exposure to us. So that's a different way of collateralizing, a different way of margining, and therefore necessarily a different way of accounting. Something of a minority, but I think if you're setting global rules, that's something to be borne in mind. Going on to the question about how things would evolve, you were talking about Dodd-Frank, and I'm sure you guys know very well there is also still a very fluid situation in Europe around exactly how the collateralization must work, both for CCPs and in the bilateral market.
I think we've even seen examples, and I think there's still some discussions around some of the mechanics around the cash flow, say, in the OTC space, and then as we brought them on the CCPs, we tried to harmonize them, so thinking about some of the coupons and things like that, the settlement cycle of them in the OTC versus cleared, and so I think across whether you're talking derivative sums, whether you're talking about collateral, everything, everyone's no longer just looking at it as OTC or cleared, they're looking at it as universe, right, and how do we make that all the same, because they don't want to have to deal in this multiple world where things behave differently.
It seems to me, talking about trends, it seems to me that the operational constraints that you were describing about how the interest rate swap system can't talk to the credit default swap system within an institution, a trend toward clearing organizations could suffer from the same issue, right? Because to the extent that you can only clear certain types of contracts on a particular system, it obviously cannot interface with a different clearing system dealing with different products. So is there a movement toward consolidation of the clearing systems so that you could have protections within the same organization for all of your transactions?
I think, well, first of all, and I just moved into, in the last couple of months into the futures and options operations group, but I will tell you, we have a single system that we use internally to manage all of the 79 clearing relationships that J.P. Morgan has. And so we absolutely can see across all of them, and we can do all kinds of interesting things if it's allowed under the rules. I think in the short term, you're going to see a proliferation of clearinghouses, because Dodd-Frank is based, and the European legislation and the Asian legislation, and everyone is saying, let's go and create clearinghouses, and there are all kinds of politics around how that's going to happen, and we're going to have multiple clearinghouses that will clear the exact same product. I think over time, commercial interest will take over, and you'll start to see some consolidation of some of those. I think within a clearinghouse, you absolutely can get netting across products if it is allowed by the regulations, and that is debatable what's going to be allowed and what's not going to be allowed. As you read the draft rules in this country and you look at the draft European legislation, I think generally, I think over time you will get that ability to do that. But I think it will actually be easier with clearing to the extent that a clearinghouse handles both interest rates and credit default swaps, which today I can't net in a bilateral space. I would see no reason why I couldn't net them if they are in the same clearinghouse in the future. And I would think that that's exactly what will happen.
But when you say net, then you mean payment net, then? Not a terminate net, then?
No, I mean both.
Well, in a bilateral, you could terminate net.
And terminate net, but the point is I can get, the point is I will get both in the clearinghouse if I have more. Today I only have one. For operational reasons, I can't payment net. In the future, I'll be able to both payment net and, of course, I'll get the termination net.
That's right.
Hey, David, I think we're going to have to wrap up. Do you want to do a sweep of your boardroom to see if any board members have questions for our guests?
Any other ones?
Any other ones?
No, I don't think so, Leslie.
Okay, any questions here? Any concluding comments?
Really appreciate the opportunity to meet today, and certainly if there's any further questions, we'd be happy to respond to those. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very important. Say 5 minutes? 10 minutes? 10 minutes.
What was that, 10 minutes?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. That was very informative.
Thank you. Well, thanks for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Kennedy Powell, take it out.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.